Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody. This is your host, Geert. I am very pleased today to be speaking to Dr. Anna Sergi. Welcome, Anna.
Hello.
Hi. So Anna Sergi, she holds a PhD in sociology, and she has a specialization in criminology from the University of Essex, and she's where she is currently a senior lecturer in courses on organized crime, security, and on globalization.
Sorry, I'm a professor now.
You're a professor now. Oh, I'm so sorry.
It's all right. I should have told you before. In between the book, I managed to get a promotion. So
there we go. Right. Well, congratulations.
There we go. So sorry, you have to do that again.
No, that's fine. Professor Anna Sergi, she specializes in mafia studies, cross-border policing of organized crime, and more recently on drug importations through seaports. And she's published extensively in several renowned journals and authored 4 books. Any additional updates besides the professorship?
Well, my next book is coming up in 2 days. So, yes, so that will be a different kind of product, but still with Bristol University Press.
Great. Okay, well, we'll go into that maybe at the end of the talk. Would be nice. So today we will be discussing with Professor Sergi the book that she co-authored with Alexandria Reed, Luca Storti, and Marlene Easton, and it's called Ports, Crime, and Security: Governing and Policing Seaports in a Changing World. Maybe to start off with, could you tell us a bit more about how you came to the your current topic of study in general? What originally drew your interest to international crime and to seaports?
Yes, so I've been working on organized crime for over a decade now. And ports have always been one of those things that started appearing everywhere I went. For a simple reason, I research mafias and mafia mobility, and the Italian mafias I research are particularly active in cocaine trade. So whenever it's about cocaine trade, you hear the respondent A, police officer, or law enforcement B, border agent, who will tell you, well, you really need to look at the port. And that the 7th billion time that people told me you really need to look at the port, then I like, okay, maybe I should look at the port. And this was specifically started with Melbourne, because I was there researching the Calabrian 'Ndrangheta, the mafia in Australia, and eventually the port kept coming up as something that was increasingly relevant to understand the movement of this group. And so I built together a project. I reached out to my colleague, Luca Storti, first. Luca and I have been working together already on some other mafia-related stuff. Luca is an economic sociologist, so I thought it was a good combination, because obviously as a criminologist, approaching port is a very daunting experience. Ports are incredibly complex, and so you do need someone with some knowledge of economics, or in that case, economic sociology, to start understanding things beyond crime, because the ports obviously is a lot more than just crime. So that's where Luca and I started doing this project. We won a grant. So we did the first part of the research. And in this research, then we met what eventually became our next colleagues. So Alexandria was, at the time, I met her because she was doing a research on free ports in the UK. So she was very interested in issues of port security in the realm of free ports and the new proposal for free ports in Brexit Britain, essentially. Brexit England. And Marlene instead had done already a lot of research on ports, specifically Antwerp, but from a very specific perspective, which was the one of public-private management. So she was looking at the public-private partnerships in the port of Antwerp, so mainly police and private sector. So we did meet in many occasions. We ran a workshop together, and from the workshop, we 7 different ports and 14 people from various countries, we essentially decided, okay, you know what, we need to put this down somehow on paper. But it felt like it couldn't be done without each of us keeping their own specialism and their own voice. And this is why the book is short, but it has, which is always a good thing, by the way, I think, for a book to be short, dense and short, but it also has a four-author, it's a four-author book because we all contributed with one chapter, we all commented on each other's chapter, and we then together wrote the introduction and the conclusion, and I was the one overseeing the project, but it was eventually a four-people effort because we bring together political economy, economic sociology, management studies, and criminology. So we couldn't have done it in another way because ports are all of this. So that's why we decided essentially to do it this way.
I see. And maybe to go back to Melbourne, what was exactly the study that you did down there? What grasping?
In Melbourne, I was looking at the differentiation, well, the diversification of criminality between Italy and Australia when it comes to the Calabrian Mafia. And one of the first things that anyone learns about the Calabrian Mafia in Australia is that they are linked to what is currently still the world's largest ecstasy bust, which is, you know, dubbed by the media this way. It's 4.4 tons of MDMA that arrived in the port of Melbourne from Italy in tomato cans, because obviously we are apparently Italian that way. And it was one of the biggest operations that Australian law enforcement did in 2008. Yes, so in 2007, 2008, it was basically one of the biggest operations that Australian Federal Police, Victoria Police, Border Agents did in Australia. And it was about 4.4 tons of MDMA and 160 kilos of cocaine arriving in tomato tins from Italy for a network, a criminal network, that was mostly related to the Calabrian Mafia. So that's when essentially I had to go and talk about the port and how eventually this whole operation happened, because it involved undercover agents, it involved a number of resources. And that's when I first glimpsed into the port. And I realized that this was a little bit, it needed to be explored a little bit better, because it just does, it's not that easy. It might seem easy, but it's not that easy for a criminal group to just exploit a port, such a port like Melbourne. Melbourne is a gigantic port, it's the biggest port of Australia. So obviously the ways in which this happens are not that intuitive. So that's essentially when I decided, okay, maybe let me start looking at other ports. And eventually I found that the Calabrian Mafia, I already knew this, but it became very obvious that their relationship with ports was kind of special in a way. So already in Calabria and in Italy more generally. So that's why I included a port in Genova. I then decided to move to the US in the port of New York and New Jersey, also because they have a specific... They had a special history with the waterfront and the mob, let's call it the mob, and then Montreal, because I already had contacts in Canada, so it was easy enough to do research in Canada for me at that time. So, and Liverpool, because I had to include a UK-based port in order to get the funding. So Liverpool seemed to be also the most interesting one in terms of criminal organizations, activity at the port, especially in the 80s, 90s. So it seemed logical as well to include Liverpool. But yeah, it all started with 4.4 tons of MDMA at the port of Melbourne, arriving in tomato tins.
And did it, Liverpool was perhaps an obligatory choice, but did it in the end give you any good results?
Liverpool was difficult, and it helped, it kind of opened up a whole other set of problems in the UK, which I'm trying to figure out as we speak. So Liverpool was chosen for two reasons. One, because the call was specifically focused on the UK, and it wanted to bring in comparative research to support UK policy. And it was just before Brexit, so it was kind of meaningful for me to include a topic that was completely overshadowed by the Brexit talks, which is port security and trafficking, illicit trade. But it also showed me how impossible it is to do research in the ports in England. And I say England and not the UK, because the rest of the UK has different ports regimes. Ports ownerships are, let's say, of different nature. In England, they are completely private. Ports in England are privatized in land and in concession. So the people, companies, corporations who run the terminals are also the ones who own the terminal land, which is kind of a unique thing. It doesn't happen very often. It's a minority of cases around the world are like this. So this essentially means that you can't enter the port, not even with the police or with the border agents, which is normally the way I got in. So it's basically you have to ask the private sector, whoever is running the port, and they might refuse you. They did not refuse me in Liverpool, but their data was rather meaningless to me, because obviously their intent is not necessarily to talk about cocaine or organized crime, but to show how fantastic the port is and how well it's running and how, you know, without crime, and the crime is a thing of the past.
And so these, okay, so the UK is a sort of specific outlier in this sense, but you already mentioned the public-private partnerships that are usually in place in the ports. Could you describe those a tiny bit and also indicate why that makes it especially such a complex environment?
Yes, so this the topic of port security is the one that we need to introduce here. So port security is a weird beast. And the chapter in the book that deals with this has been mainly curated by Marlene, is chapter 3, but obviously also in the chapter I curated, which was the one about policing, there is some overlap about that for simple reason, which is not simple at all, actually. So port security is something that grew out of 9/11, as a lot of national security, crisis that we had after 9/11. So it's a regulation, it's an international set of laws which imposed on every port around the world to obey certain standard rules to secure the premises of the port. But securing the premises of the port means essentially making sure that there is no terror attack, no infrastructure meltdown in terms of cyber meltdown or physical meltdown, no stowaways, God forbid we have stowaways in ports, and remotely also criminal activity, but in a very vague sense, not quite clear what it means. And this is normally attributed to whoever is running the port terminal, which is usually a private, in 80% of the cases in the world, it's usually the private sector. So someone who has the lease over the land for, let's say, 40, 50 years, and they manage the terminal that way. But eventually, port security is also a matter of, even if it's privatized, it's also a matter for the public sector to worry about. Because obviously, if you ever have a risk of terror attack or a stowaway or a criminal activity in port, and the land on which the port sits remains public land, so remains somehow leased to the private sector, then obviously it is still land that is policed by law enforcement that run in the place that we are talking about in the context. Whether this is national police, local police, federal police, that's beyond, well, that depends on the port, essentially, on where the port is and how the port management is organized in the specific country. But there is that essentially brings in as a necessary step a way of talking. They need to talk. The private sector needs to talk with the public sector and vice versa. The police needs to be able to enter the port to carry out their investigations or their arrest or their seizures. And the private sector needs to be able to call on the police or whoever else, law enforcement, for support. In all this, we are often forgetting, but it became very obvious in the research that many of the ports we looked at, especially big seaports, large container seaports, are also borders. So obviously this means that commodities as much as people from abroad come in through certain gates, which are ports. And this also means that you will have border management and border authorities and customs in ports. And usually the role of custom is the one that is the most important in the daily management of ports, because customs is the one who is usually allowed to open containers, who is usually allowed to check on people, on cars, on ships. They are the one who somehow manage the border. So that is, it can happen in different ways. Each country has their own specification, but all of these authorities, which are fairly complex authorities already, will need to find ways to cooperate. And this is where public-private partnership will need to emerge. Some countries are doing better than others. Some countries are not doing it, like in the UK. And some countries have somehow created third units. So where you have the so-called security networks, where specialist people from each of these institutions meet, and they create a third unit, which is the port unit. Usually there is someone who will lead this unit. In Australia, this is, for example, led by Victoria Police, which is state police in Melbourne. In Montreal, instead, you have RCMP, Royal Canadian Mounted Police, so a federal border management unit of the federal police. In the United States, you have CBP, Customs and Border Control. So they are the one who lead this partnership. So the ones who call the other to essentially discuss what needs to be done. So this, without this partnership, the port security and policing would collapse, because there is one massive, massive problem with securing and policing the port, which is that, with the exception of the UK in this case, the port remains rented out. There is no other way of saying it. Now, I don't know how many of the listeners rent a flat, but if you rent a flat, you know that people cannot enter in your flat, not even your leaseholder or your property owner, unless you allow them. So being allowed in the port premises is the main issue. You have to make sure that you can enter the port premises and not every single time knock at the door. Because if you knock at the door, you'll lose time. But the port is a weird space, because it requires this constant negotiation between the public sector and the private sector. And unless you have a system in place to streamline this, you'll never get out of the impasse. And this happens on a daily basis. It has to be smooth. So that's the main struggle, essentially.
What are your experiences with that? Do you think usually it does work, the entrance of police? Or...
Yeah, well, it's strange, because obviously you can sense the tension all around. In every port I've visited, everyone tells you, oh no, we work well with the port. And they usually name the port under the name of the terminal owner. We work well with DP World, we work well with whoever. And when you actually start scratching a little bit, you'll see that this works well is not really always the case, because the police would want to do more. They would want to stay inside the port, and they are not allowed to most of the time. So sometimes they sit outside right outside. It's very curious to see. You have this massive, let's say, fencing around ports, and then just outside you have the little building where the police sits or the custom sits, so that they are very close to entering, but not just inside. And some other times instead is the opposite. You have a very important person in every port terminal who is the port facility security officers, the PFSO. So this is usually the head of security. Is someone who has undergone a certain specific training and is supposed to be the person who decides on a daily basis who enters, who exits, who signs off the access sheet and the exit sheets, and who oversees the whole security, essentially, of the port. So it's a very, very important person. It's the person you need to get to if you want to enter the port. The person I needed to get to, if I wanted to enter the port as a researcher, and you have to explain to them what you're doing. So they are kind of like the king of the realm, because without them, you can't enter. And usually the personality, the charisma or lack of charisma of these people is the one that creates problems. So you'll see place where for 20 years things went smoothly, there was a very good relationship, and then the PFSO changes and the whole thing goes back to square one. So you see all these tensions, and everyone is very diplomatic and everyone politically correct and tells you, oh no, we have all the protocols in place, but then you can sense in their voice how this is not really the case. And the police will always want to do more in the port, and the PFSO does not want to let the police more because this scares away clients. If you have the police inside the port terminals, does not look good. It looks like the port is not secure. So there is this constant balance in pretty much everywhere. And then you have the weirdest thing of all, which is where the UK, the England really, really tops off, which is that England has a private police force in ports, meaning that the security employee of the terminal owner are police officers. So they are sworn police officers. They have the same power of any other police officer in the country, but they are private employees. So that's a very weird combination, because obviously they do feel the duplicity of their role, because they have a public and they have a private employee and a private private corporation that pays their paycheck, but at the same time they are sworn to public safety and maintaining public peace. So it's not quite clear where they stand. More research should be done on that for sure, but it's not going to be me, because I found it extremely difficult as well. And let's not even get into how masculine this all is, because that's a whole other story as a female researcher.
Fascinating. Yes. Would you say that this, because we so far we've spoken about the security part, the officials, so to say, and that kind of collaboration. But you also mentioned a lot about corruption in the book. Would you say that this security industry that the criminal industry mirrors this security industry?
So in a way, organized crime groups have to learn how to get around the security infrastructure that each port puts in place. There's a very simple, let's say, principle of criminology, which is crime displacement. The more security you put up, the more criminal groups will move around that security for necessity. So you can never stop really the crime flow. You can just divert it in a way. So the most important thing that criminal groups need to do when using the ports, either as a gate or as an entry point or an exit point or just a transit point, is to have knowledge of someone who has knowledge of the port, meaning that there are individuals or sometimes entire groups whose sole job is to offer the know-how of the port security system to the criminal groups. So the specific example of that I can give is the so-called West End Gang in Montreal. So Montreal is peculiar in that sense because the criminal group that is commonly associated to the port, meaning that they have the know-how of how the port works, is solely there in the port to essentially act as a guarantor for other groups. So they do not import drugs. They do not operate in any other criminal activity. Their sole criminal activity is to branch out, to bridge one criminal group to the port. So they will be the one overseeing activities in the port premises. They will be the one getting paid for a fee so that their shipment of someone else goes through. So they will be essentially, they are the guardians in a way of the port. So this is a unique case, the one on Montreal, because normally you have, each group has their own individuals in the port, or one individual acts as a broker, let's say, for various others. But Montreal is specific because there is this clear identification of a criminal group whose only specialism is to give access to the port to other criminal groups. And they only can do that if they know and they follow how the security and the policing of the port premises evolve. They wouldn't be able to do it any other way. So they are either port employees, or they are security officers sometimes, or people very close to the above.
Fascinating. Yes. So would you say, does this tie in to the union structure that sometimes is in place? I mean, viewers might remember the images from Baltimore in The Wire, where this union group collaborates with organized crime.
Yes, absolutely. And in fact, so in the book, in chapter one, which was the chapter which was curated by Luca Storti, Luca does mention the role of unions, specifically in relationship to the type of economic system in place in the different ports. So obviously, ports are incredibly important nodes of the political economy of each country. And all the actors of this economy will play a role. In some economic system, specifically the liberal economic system, unions have a very important role of balancing out essentially the free reins of the liberal market in a way, and protect obviously the workers in the process. So their let's say relationship with the private sector is incredibly conflictual sometimes. So we saw this in the US, very much the case, in Canada, still very much the case, but increasingly so also in Europe. So I was recently, this is not in the book, but I was recently in the port of Piraeus, and there are three union workers in the port of Piraeus, all of them very angry at Costco, who is the new owner of the Piraeus port and terminal. So the conflictuality between the workers and the, you know, the port employers is very prominent in our analysis as well. It has definitely shaped what we saw in New York and what we saw in Montreal, also Melbourne. And it is where all the stories of organized crime somehow start. To the extreme of the US, where organized crime groups, mafia type groups, tend to get the governance of the unions. Essentially, by infiltrating the union, they manage to control the entire workforce. And this is something that the employers are scared of, because if port workers stop working or decide to point their feet, the port stops working. So meaning that trade is halted. So that can happen. And at the same time, there are many ways in which the unions come into play in terms of manipulation by organized crime groups, in terms of infiltration by organized crime groups. So you have very different levels, but they all have to somehow, they acquire importance depending on how important the union system is in the country of destination. For example, in Australia, the unions that run the port, the Painters and Dockers Union, which is also the, I've learned the reason why there was a four-volume inquiry into organized crime at the Port of Melbourne in the mid-80s changed drastically since the mid-80s. So it's the unions went through a reform, the union system went through a reform in the general economics of the state. So it really depends on, it has a history of its own, and then within the history of the of labor relationship, you will find also the port.
This gives me the intuition that if you say that on the one hand, more security measures only displace the crime, and on the other hand, the most of the crime in the ports starts with the unskilled labor and troubles in that part of the system, would you then say that actually the security issues in the port should be tackled through a kind of social or labor related policy?
They can, they should actually. I think one of the suggestions that I'm currently exploring and we did discuss with my colleagues for the book is that there is something that is usually gets forgotten when organized crime, countering organized crime policies happen. And there is a lot of confusion on what organized crime looks like in ports, hence the book, which is that so-called temperature checks of the labor workforce. Temperature checks means not necessarily looking at whether the employees are happy or not happy, but whether or not their conditions of labor are somehow leading to discontent, which gets systemic and therefore gets exploitable. And this is something that gets forgotten because there is always misrepresentation of the role of port workers in organized crime. You have countries who will say, oh no, these are a few bad apples that once in a while get corrupted and we get rid of the bad apples and the whole system gets fine, which is untrue. Or the opposite is true, where, oh my God, this is everywhere. We can't possibly face it. All the port workers are inherently corrupted or corruptible. Therefore, let's just put more controls in place because there's no way of saving them, which is obviously not true. But we saw that in certain countries, specifically more than others, controls over the workforce to avoid criminal connections are taken obviously with another very conflictual manner. For example, New York City, New York Harbor, has a very unique structure, which is the Waterfront Commission, which sits over two states, New York and New Jersey, because the Port of New York sits over two states, New York and New Jersey. So this Waterfront Commission exists since 1954, the year before the movie On the Waterfront came out, and it's already featuring in the movie The Waterfront, with a very young Marlon Brando. And the idea of the Waterfront Commission is that everyone who ever will work at the port in any, let's say, job, will have to undergo through an intelligence-led scrutiny by the commission to check whether there are organized crime ties. It's been over 70 years since the commission started its work, and there are millions of reasons why New Jersey doesn't want this commission, but the idea is that on the side of workers is perceived as a threat to work, is being perceived as a threat to the diversification of the labor force, because there seems to be some claims of racism, which are unproven, but, you know, still claims. And at the same time, it doesn't even please the terminals in a way, because it still hinders the speed of recruitment. So that's one way of doing it. So to make sure that everyone undergoes a certain check just for organized crime, or even worse, like Canada does, where a ministry of Transport Canada will run the checks over everyone who works in ports and airports. And we run basically just a checklist, whether if your brother has been involved in organized crime, you can't get any work in the port, no matter what. So this obviously brings on the union and the claims of racism and classism and all of those issues. And even more, increases the conflictuality between the port workers and the perceived controls that someone in the employer realm is making. So the temperature checks are important not just to catch the occasional person who gets corrupted because they need money to do something, so the occasional dockers who just does it once in a while, but to make sure that the more systemic infiltration into certain structures, including the unions, is not inherently conducive to organized crime influence, is not already calling for it to spite the employer. So it's very complicated, but it never really features on any organized crime, let's say, counter strategy somehow.
One of the recommendations that you give in the book is that the solutions for security issues in ports should always be very localized. But at the same time, me as a person who has hardly been in any of the larger ports, I have the feeling that the ports throughout the world look more like each other than, for instance, a port in the Netherlands looks like the rest of the Netherlands. Why then these highly localized solutions are needed? Is that culturally dependent? For instance, are Asian ports fundamentally different from the ones in Australia, or is there another dimension?
That's a very good point and question. Both are true. So all ports look similar, and at the same time, all ports look different. As someone told me once, when you've seen one port, you've only really seen one port, which means essentially that if you really want to know how the port environment really works, it takes really a long time. They might appear very similar to one another in the same way as some of the basic features of the so-called world cities look similar to one another. New York is very similar to London for certain macro dynamics, or to Paris or to Rome. But then when you actually go to Rome or go to Paris or go to New York, you do see the differences. So it's the same idea. So the ports are the most globalized of our economic tools. Are probably like airports, they are meant to be recognizable to everyone who sets foot from everywhere in the world at the first glimpse. I've recently been to the port of Cartagena with the port facility security officer telling me, look, we are meant to look exactly like
Cartagena in Colombia.
Cartagena in Colombia. So we are talking here about the biggest port of the Caribbean in Colombia, and they are modeled security-wise and also non-security-wise on Rotterdam. And having seen both, if you drop me from the sky on one of them, I wouldn't know necessarily where I am. They look exactly the same, apart from the context around them. And the fact that in one case you have the sea in one way, or you see the skyline on the other way. So they look contextually dissimilar, but inside they are very similar. So this is very true, and this is the reason why all the port security regulations eventually do look are necessarily the same. There has to be a language that is shared across port security officers around the world, usually in English, but not necessarily, so to share the experiences. However, when it comes to organized crime, this is where things get different, and this is where the cultural element comes in, because the organized crime scenario will change just outside the port premises. It will matter whether or not organized crime groups or any other criminal groups that uses the port has certain types of features outside of the port, whether they exist in the city behind the port, whether they're coming from somewhere else, whether they are instead just forming for the sake of the criminal venture of choice. To give you an example, I was expecting Montreal to show a very high level of engagement from the bikies, the outlaw motorcycle gangs, who are heavily engaged in cocaine in Quebec, in importation of cocaine. I was expecting them to traffic this cocaine through the port of Montreal. Surprise, they don't. They do not use the port of Montreal. They prefer to ship cocaine. And when I say they prefer, I mean that occasionally they also do use Montreal, but mostly they don't. They use the port of Vancouver, which is on the other side of the country, and it takes 6 days to bring it from Vancouver to Montreal. But their contact in Vancouver is probably safer, and their route is probably quicker and safer from Vancouver to Montreal than it would be to move things directly to Montreal. Now, what does this tell me is that these groups from Montreal will have to organize their criminal network in a way that makes it possible for them to act through the port of Vancouver instead, which is their, you know, inside contacts, outside contacts, it doesn't matter. But this also means that if I go and look at the port of Vancouver, I'll find this very odd group that does not live there but uses the port nevertheless. Instead, the port of Montreal seems to be particularly attractive for criminal groups in North New York, because it is easier to move things across the border between Canada and US than it would be for them to move it from New York City, where the control over the territory of the port is much, much higher from other criminal groups. So the thing with organized crime is that it doesn't necessarily go in the intuitive way. So if you and I choose a port because it's the closest to our home and it makes more sense to have a quicker journey and a cheaper journey and a whatever, safer journey for my, let's say, furniture to go from the Netherlands to the US if I decide to move there, why wouldn't I use the port next door to mine? But for organized crime, it doesn't work like that. So that's why you need a contextual and a local understanding of how organized crime works in the region around the port to make sure you understand certain choices in terms of how the port system is exploited, especially for trafficking, but not just for trafficking. A whole other story is when a criminal group does not do trafficking, but they just do the corruption at the higher level or the union governance. That's an even more localized issue. And in that sense, it has nothing to do with the previous one sometimes. You might have more than one organized crime group active in the same port. So the port trade system is the same everywhere. The port security system is going towards homogeneity everywhere, but organized crime is not homogeneous everywhere. So that is the changing thing. So both our statements can be correct.
Thank you for that. In your opinion, when we look at the worldwide port system and the organized crime in there, the GITOC, the Global Initiative Against Transnational Organized Crime, one of their major concerns on when it comes to organized crime is that they say that global drug trade is the pressing issue. Perhaps if you look at the port system specifically, what is your biggest worry, let's say, when it comes to security for the foreseeable future?
That's a tough one. I think my main issue is the amount of data that we generate. Not because I'm afraid that someone will read my emails, I don't really care, but because the manipulation of data is something that we can't control. There is no way. I don't do research on big data, and I don't do research on the management of big data. But I think that in terms of security, that's the challenge: the production of data, whether it's for trade, whether it's for personal sensitive data, whether that is for understanding of the world's connection or political connection. I think that is something that can be easily manipulated in ways that are not even criminal in a way, or criminalized yet. And I'm not advocating for more criminalization, but I'm advocating probably for less security in a way, because the security generates more data. The need for security generates more data. We store more data because we are obsessed with security and we think that by storing more data, we can somehow control it, but I'm not too sure this is the case. And we've seen this during the pandemic with the halt of port trade and the never-ending anxiety the ports at this stage share about cyber attacks and cyber terror attacks, which are very unlikely. But eventually, if you think of the amount of work that goes behind the scenes for storing all the incredible amount of information that each port receives every day about shipment and people and movement, is just where all this data go. And because most of the time it is not really needed for security, the way we think of it, is probably where we are clearly doing something wrong. So I think that's really where the problem lies. And then obviously with drugs is a whole other story. I mean, I'm looking forward to seeing how Canada is planning on legalizing cocaine, because that will be a path-breaking situation. I'm for it. I'm definitely for it. Not because I consume cocaine. Never consume cocaine in my life. I don't intend to, but I believe in free will. To these matters. But at the same time, this will give a massive blow to organized crime, and ports will have to change yet again their understanding of security and illicit trade.
That's an exciting experiment indeed that will take place in Canada. I think you make a very interesting point about the data collection. Specifically, do you mean that the risk is that the attack surface in ports has become larger? Would you say that the risk lies in the field of the cyber attacks, or is it more a risk that there is some kind of negative side effects of this hyper surveillance that, for instance, thwarts the world trade or endangers the workers?
Well, I think it's an effect of the so-called risk society, which is a wonderful, now old concept, 1992, 1991, I think it was, by Ulrich Beck, who obviously was a sociologist, and he saw things in a bigger macro changes. And we are definitely living in the worst of the risk societies ever, where data is collected just in case it's needed at some point. And the responses I had from the ports, and this is something that we discussed for the book, it is in our conclusion of the book, is that everyone is preparing for the worst case scenario all the time in ports. And the worst case scenario in ports is definitely something related to cyber terrorism. Whether if you halt a whole port system, we've seen this. We've seen it when the Evergreen was somehow blocked in the middle of the Suez Canal. If one port enters in a complete blockage, the rest of the world is going to collapse. So everyone is very, very sure of this and very aware of the implications of a cyber attack in, let's say, one of the nodal points. And by cyber attack, yes, it means essentially being able to control from remote and to held hostage, essentially, the information that each port is managing. This is dramatic for the clients, for the governments, for whoever, essentially. So this is the nightmare. And they do drills and they do courses and trainings, and the risk of this is so tangible. And it is essentially the idea ingrained in the fact that if we do not hyper-surveil, if we do not do this hyper-surveillance, we run zero chance. We have zero chance of making it out of this alive. But the opposite is also true, because all the time that we spend with this, not that I'm not saying that one shouldn't worry about this, is essentially the same time that we essentially spend by giving ammunition to whoever is inclined to run these cyber attacks. If all the data that we store and all the system we rely upon in order to be able to resist a cyber attack are the same infrastructures and data that will be used in case of a cyber attack. So I'm not going back to the pen and paper, of course, that's not the point. But at the same time, I feel like the risk of the threat is definitely overshadowing the logics of the response. But this is not for just for ports. Ports are just the way you do see it, because when something, anything happens in ports, going from the pandemic to the Evergreen and the Suez Canal, the rest of the it's actually the only economy of the world where capitalism is at its full blown power. There is really no, there is only the invisible hand of the market. There is no one else. It's the most non-regulated economic system that we have, the one of port, where one port depends on the other and you don't understand why unless you are an expert on these issues. So again, it's an egg chicken and egg situation. And I don't think I have the answer, but definitely criminology has been looking at this, at the effects of the over-surveillance for anything from human rights to personal safety, for ontological insecurity, this idea that we're constantly, you know, insecure because we are constantly under attack, not sure. And then, yeah, this all connects to broader things, but yeah, I'm not sure we should go there.
maybe for next time, but thanks for the elaborate answer. Maybe a final question. So you already alluded that to your new book coming out in 2 days. Could you maybe tell us a tiny bit about that? What's it going to be?
Yeah. So the book is called Chasing the Mafia, 'Ndrangheta Memories and Journeys. And it's, again, with Bristol University Press, but this time is a non-fiction book. So it's, I would say, 60-70% academic, 30-40% trade. And it's basically the kind of research that I've always run on the side. There is a little bit of my research on ports even there, specifically in the port of Gioia Tauro in Calabria, where I was born. And that's been basically my first port, even if I wasn't looking for it. It's been, I grew up around it. And it's basically an idea. And the idea of the book is to try and do a little bit of self-ethnography and mix it with real ethnography that I've done over the years in my fieldwork in Australia, Canada, US, including my fieldwork for ports, but always still chasing mafia stuff. And the result should be a personal book. It's written in first person. It's about my childhood memories, my fieldwork diaries, and eventually my professional challenges as an academic researching these topics that are very close to my personal life in a way. So it's a mix of voices. The idea was to mix the researcher with the child and the professional academic with, let's say, the someone who tries to make sense of history of the place where she comes from. So it's, yeah, in 2 days it's going to come out in Europe and then Australia and then Canada. So let's see how that goes. But this was eventually written even before Ports and Crime and Security. It just took longer to publish it because it was more problematic in a way.
We've got something to look forward to. Thank you once again, Anna Sergi. And who knows, we'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.